And welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Sean Corcoran, Managing Editor of News at WCAI. This is our local news roundup. During the next hour, we'll discuss some of the top news stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is Anne Brennan. She's the Assistant Managing Editor for Digital Media at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Hello, Anne.
Hello, Sean.
Good morning. And we have several other local journalists joining us throughout the show. And, of course, we'll hear from Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Jim DeRuiter is calling in from the New Bedford Standard Times. He's the editorial page editor there. Jeff Spillane is a reporter at the Mashpee Enterprise. We'll hear from Jeff. And later in the show, we'll talk to Nelson Siegelman from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Let's start with the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. And we heard from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission this week about spent fuel rods. And as we've reported over the years, there is a pool of filled with spent fuel rods at the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. They'd had some permissions to move some of them out of that pool and into what are called dry cask. But now the NRC, which regulates, obviously, all the nuclear power stations in the country, is saying, hold on with those dry casks and those spent fuel rods.
Right. There was a vote on Tuesday of the commission at which four of five commissioners voted to end further consideration of a plan by the NRC to expedite transfer of the radioactive fuel rods from the cooling pools, which are the main storage area now for spent fuel rods, to dry casks. And this would have applied across the country. The dissenting vote, the chairman of the commission, Allison McFarlane, voted against stopping this expedited movement of fuel rods, saying that the transfer, they needed to do more study. The NRC staff had recommended that the expediting of this movement to dry casks was not necessary because the spent fuel pools could withstand an earthquake and therefore they wouldn't crack or anything and water wouldn't leak from them in such an instance. Whereas McFarland said, well, you only looked at earthquakes. Maybe we should be looking at things beyond earthquakes to make sure that these pools are okay as they stand.
Yeah, these pools were always expected to be temporary.
Right.
The government thought that some state would, perhaps Nevada, would take all this nuclear waste and store it somewhere and it wouldn't be an issue. But that hasn't happened.
Right. That they were going to use Yucca Mountain in Nevada. That plan was tabled or actually declared dead in 2010. The citizens of Nevada didn't really want a nuclear waste disposal site in their state. And during the Obama administration, that plan disappeared. There's no plan at this point. And Senator Markey is saying this is a real dire situation because in the case of Pilgrim, the spent fuel pool was designed for about 800 spent fuel assemblies. It's holding more than 3,200 now. And in order to put new spent fuel in, they have to move old fuel out and put them into these dry casks. And, you know, people are saying Pilgrim, the problem, an issue might be an airplane crashing into the nuclear power plant could cause, because the fuel pool is on the top floor above the main containment, it could be a nuclear disaster. Those things aren't being talked about, according to Markey. In fact, Markey had filed a bill with some other senators that if it's passed, will force utilities who have nuclear power plants, give them 180 days to come up with a plan for moving the spent fuel assemblies into dry casks and to have a plan for that and then a number of years deadline before they have to have it done. Mm. And I just want to add this whole report by the NRC staff on whether the rod should be moved from the pools in an expedited fashion comes out of a study post-Fukushima. And Fukushima was the plant in Japan that there was an earthquake, but it was the tsunami after the earthquake that washed up on the nuclear power plant and took down the backup power supplies. And that made it so that they couldn't keep water circulating in all of the four spent fuel pools. And one of them had a meltdown and a release of radiation.
Yeah. And it's worth noting that Fukushima also had some fuel in dry casks, and those did well during that disaster.
Right.
So the NRC has to get its arms around this, because in some ways, some of these power plants are running out of space to put their spent fuel. And as you said, if they have no place to put it, they can't continue to function.
And my understanding is that the casks last about 20 years if they're above ground. I believe the idea is that you would put the spent fuel rods into these casks and then ship them off to wherever the nuclear waste facility was going to be. And the utilities have been putting money, they've been required to put money into a fund that would go to disposal of nuclear waste. So there's, you know, I don't know how many billions, but it's in the billions of dollars of money available.
Yeah.
So this was part of the plan, but the part of the plan that hasn't happened is where they're going to put it.
Right. A new urgent care clinic has opened on Long Pond Drive in Harwich. It's a new medical center. It's going to serve the lower and outer Cape. We knew it was coming. I think Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle talked about it a few weeks ago. Story in today's Cape Cod Times about how it has opened.
Right. It opened on May 19th, and there was an open house yesterday so people could come in and look around. This facility it was a $1.6 million project, and it's part of Cape Cod Healthcare's larger effort to move away from hospital-based care and have more satellite urgent care so that, there's high-level emergencies that should go to an emergency room, and maybe not such high, somebody's sick, somebody breaks an arm, these kinds of things that they could go to this urgent care center rather than to the emergency room. They opened another urgent care facility in Sandwich, I believe, last year. And this is designed to bring down the cost of health care.
But it's the same staff they're seeing that they would see in the emergency
room
if they went to Hyannis or Falmouth.
Right. In a situation where you don't have all the costs of the hospital that come to play in the pricing of the care in the emergency room, as these clinics are smaller, they're designed to for specific, urgent care, not traumatic injury type emergencies. It also, for the people on the lower and outer Cape, they've been really looking for something like this. If you can imagine living in Provincetown and you have an emergency, you have to go all the way to Cape Cod Hospital. That's an hour when there's not traffic. So this allows people on the outer and lower Cape closer access to an urgent care facility, which is something, according to Senator Dan Wolf, there's been a huge outcry for several years.
Let's talk about Wellfleet. We're used to talking about the police department in Provincetown, which has had some troubles over the past year or so. Now we're hearing about some concerns among residents in the town of Wellfleet. In fact, I believe there was a petition going around in Wellfleet about some police conduct.
Right. Earlier this week, in fact, at a Board of Selectmen meeting, Sharon Lindsay brought a petition that had been signed by 30 residents seeking the removal of Officer Robert Burns. They say that he's aggressive and unreasonable, and the Board of Selectmen heard what she had to say and decided that they're going to hold a meeting in June. They haven't decided what day yet. Forum that the public can be there, as well as a police chief, Ronald Fizette, so that they can talk about this.
Reading the reporting on this, it seems like there had been some concerns earlier regarding interactions with this particular officer and some young folks in town. But there was actually an incident that was very public in front of a restaurant. It's a little vague exactly what happened. Maybe more will come out. But that was kind of the tipping point, it seems.
Right. Jacob Dalby and Lauren Clements were driving home from a Kentucky Derby party that they had been at on May 3rd. It was about 10:30 in the evening. And they had two 12-year-olds in the back seat of their car. And Dalby was pulled over by a police officer allegedly for speeding and erratic driving. And Officer Burns then joined the car stop and apparently was trying to give, according to the police report, trying to give Dalby a sobriety test. Apparently, Lauren Clements allegedly started kind of objecting from the car and got out of the car. In the end, there was a skirmish, and both of them were handcuffed and arrested, put in a squad car and taken off to the police department. The children were taken to the restaurant nearby and waited for a relative to come pick them up. And people are feeling that, again, that Burns in this situation acted too aggressively, and that it resulted in this skirmish. And it's just an example of what's been going on. Dalby has been charged with operating under the influence and other charges. And Lauren Clement also faces charges of disturbing the peace and resisting arrest.
Okay, well, again, it's hard to know exactly what happened there. Maybe the selectmen will be able to get more out of it. Go ahead,
Anne. I just want to add that Fichette was saying, is standing behind his officers and saying, we'll see what the court decides. I'll be, that's whatever the court decides is what I'll accept that.
I see. Let's move over to the county jail where there was There was an inmate who died unattended death, and but it's come out now that he had drugs in his system. Heroin? We don't know.
They said opiates.
Opiates.
This was John Shannon, 31, of Hyannis, originally from Brighton, who was found dead in his cell at about 6 in the morning last Friday. And an autopsy was performed, and preliminary tests showed that there were opiates in his urine. Further toxicology tests are being done, but those usually take a lot longer to come back.
So that raises lots of questions. How did he get the drugs into the jail, that type of thing? And how come no one was checking on him? Boy, lots of questions that can come out of a story like this.
Right. Well, I just want to say that the district attorney, Michael O'Keefe, is not saying that it was a drug overdose. The implication is there, but he's saying it's still under investigation. But if it was a drug overdose, obviously Shannon had been in jail, for more than a month. So either he was already getting them, somehow he was getting opiates to have it in his urine. And the Burnsville County Sheriff Jim Cummings was saying that drugs are often smuggled into the jail. They said the most highly smuggled drug is Suboxone.
Is that a withdrawal drug?
Suboxone. I believe so.
Yeah.
And that they come in strips, and you can put it on the back of postage stamps or even children's artwork. Another way drugs get in is people use body orifices. Often that can be caught if somebody's coming into the jail. They do go through a strip search and full body search. But the third way is if an inmate or a person knows that they're going to be starting a jail term and they're coming to court knowing that I'm going from court to jail, they can put drugs into a balloon, tie it up, and swallow it. And it takes about a day or so for the balloon to went through somebody's digestive system, and once it's out, it can be used.
So the sheriff has some ideas about perhaps different ways he can combat drugs getting into the jail, and those will obviously be talked about, and we'll pay attention and figure out.
Right. Well, one of the things they do is 15 to 20 cell searches every day for contraband, sometimes with drug dogs.
Yeah.
But if they don't have X-ray equipment, so that they could see a balloon in somebody's intestinal or digestive tract, that would cost $30,000 to $40,000. But they're working on it and very well aware that it's happening.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break here from The Point on WCAI. When we come back, Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle, will join us. And welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI when we discuss the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran, and with me in our Woods Hole studio is Ann Brennan, the Assistant Managing Editor for Digital Media at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Joining us on the phone is Tim Wood. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Sean.
Thanks for joining us. I understand there's some news about the Monomoy Theater.
Sure. The Monomoy Theater on Main Street here is a pretty venerable institution. It's been around for close to 100 years. The Ohio University has been affiliated with Monomoy for 57 years. 57 years ago is when Elizabeth Baker, who was the wife of then-president of the university, bought the property, and it became home to their summer theater program. Now, over the years, the Ohio University players have gained a really good reputation as one of the top summer stock theaters on the Cape. Last year, however, a new dean took over the School of Fine Arts, and she sent her facilities people out to Chatham to check things out. And they determined that the theater and the associated buildings, some of which date back to 1800, need about $2 million in work to bring things up to code. That led the university to decide not to renew its lease on the university, which expires at the end of the year. That lease also requires that they maintain the property, including the facilities. Now, Dean Margaret Kennedy Degas cited in her announcement the facility needs, saying it didn't make sense for the university to spend that much money on a property, number one, it didn't own, and that was so far from their Athens, Ohio campus. Now, this season's productions will go on as planned, beginning June 17th with Kiss Me, Kate. Students have already begun to arrive, both from University of Ohio as well as other schools around the country. And Artistic Director Alan Russ said, since the announcement was made, he's heard from at least three universities based in New England who are interested in taking over the lease.
Okay.
So he's confident that Monomoy Theater will be with us for a long time to come. So he's going to be exploring with those universities different options for participating in the summer program over the course of the next few months.
And I'm speaking with Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle, and the Chronicle is located in Chatham. Now, Chatham's a community where the sands are always shifting out there. Inlets are emerging and closing all the time. I think we've talked in the past, Tim, about South Beach Inlet, and you said there was some hope there that that would develop into a navigable channel, but that hasn't happened?
It hasn't happened, unfortunately. There were actually two inlets in South Beach. One formed in 2013, and this past winter, another one formed just north of that inlet. And it was widely anticipated that those two inlets, which were separated only by a few hundred yards, would emerge and create one very large inlet with a nice, deep, navigable channel so boaters could easily get from Nantucket Sound to the open Atlantic. It would be a quick passage from people in Harwich and Chatham and beyond, instead of having to go all the way around Monomoy Island, which is a seven mile, hour or two trip. We're heading into boating season now, obviously, and there are still two inlets and a lot of sand in between them and inside them. Aerial photos that we published this week show just extensive shoaling all around those inlets. And Harbormaster Stuart Smith said he had planned to mark a channel through one of those inlets this summer, but there's no channel there now. He said there's nothing to mark. He plans to reassess that situation on a regular basis and says he'll probably end up putting some kind of markers through the best, deepest water through there. But he said right now it's so shallow in there that he can't even use the usual buoys he uses because at low tide they're laying on their side.
Oh, my.
And this is all part of that evolution of that barrier beach, as you said. This week I spoke with Dr. Graham Geis, who said that that whole portion of South Beach is in the breakup stage, and it's basically migrating to the west onto North Monomoy. And this, of course, as we also talked about, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is claiming part of that part of South Beach as part of Monomoy, as part of their new management plan, and the town's disputing that. But it's really a matter of time, the experts say, before that whole beach is part of Monomoy, and that will create most likely more open water for boaters. This entire situation is highly fluid, if you'll pardon me.
Okay. Let's move on to a school story, and I know this was a story that was in the Cape Cod Chronicle as well as the Cape Cod Times. Harwich High School, which is going away, which will be demolished. I guess there was some permissions given to some of the students there to use some paint inside the building, and things kind of got out of hand, and it ended up being people end up in the hospital. Lay this out for us, Tim.
Well, yes, you're right. Apparently, last Thursday evening, seniors were told that they could put handprints using paint on one of the walls inside the building. And that sort of got out of hand, and they ended up, the students ended up spray painting graffiti throughout one of the buildings in the hallway in the atrium. Nothing unseemly, just sort of seniors rule, that kind of thing. And they also climbed up onto the clock tower, and wrote 2014 and put their initials above it, which probably wasn't very smart. The principal, Kevin Turner, when he saw that, he called the students into school last Friday, which was supposed to be senior skip day, and had them...
Is that an official holiday, Tim?
Sorry.
Is that an official holiday, Tim? Senior skip day?
In Harwich, apparently.
Oh, my. Okay.
Traditional, maybe, let's call it that.
There you go.
But as they were cleaning up the graffiti, unfortunately, the solvent that they were using was stronger than anticipated, and some of the kids were overcome with some of the fumes. I don't think anybody went to the hospital. They did call the fire department, the rescue squad, and they ended up closing school last Friday because of those odors. And the students returned, the seniors returned on Saturday to finish the cleanup, most of the cleanup job. Obviously the students figured that since the school's being torn down, what harm could it do? But school officials said that, there's a number of events being planned in that school in the next few weeks, including an alumni last dance, which is taking place this Saturday. So school officials, wanted it to be presentable. As I think the Cape Cod Times reported this morning, Superintendent Scott Carpenter is continuing to investigate this, and there's reports that a teacher has been put on leave because he was supposed to be supervising this event. We're keeping up on this story, and we'll have more. In next week's paper. As of right now, the superintendent says there's not going to be any criminal charges, and the students will be allowed to graduate. But there will be some consequences apparently from this this event.
Yeah, sounds like things just got out of hand.
Kevin Turner was saying that there was a teacher who had originally agreed to supervise this, and then the kids said that another teacher has volunteered, so that second teacher is the one who apparently was at the school at the time, and that there was a miscommunication about what the kids were actually allowed to do.
Sure.
And the teacher that was actually at the school said you can spray paint whatever you want as long as it's nothing untoward or nasty.
Right.
But there are people who are really troubled by the fact that it was evening and that kids climbed up to the roof and painted, as Tim said, the 2014. It's like a 50-foot drop. So,
well, it sounds like the teacher didn't know that was going on outside. It really just sounds like, they're trying to do something lighthearted and fun,
right,
and it got out of hand, some miscommunication, and it's a good thing no one really got sick. Good. Tim, something to add?
No, just that, I know they're continuing to investigate this, and, obviously the seniors were kind of enthusiastic since it's their last year at the school, and it's the school's last year. It's going to be torn down over the course of the summer, so.
Oh, yeah, I remember what it was like to be a senior in high school. Okay, you can follow Tim at the Cape Cod Chronicle Newsroom on Twitter, at CCC Newsroom. You can also get regular updates on the Cape Cod Chronicle Facebook page or at its website, capecodchronicle.com. Tim Wood is the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks, Sean.
We'll talk to you soon. Also on the phone now is Jim DeRuta. He's the editorial page editor at the New Bedford Standard Times and SouthCoastToday.com. Hello, Jim.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning to you. So we've seen some action in the pursuit of a casino in that particular area of Massachusetts, New Bedford Fall River area. New Bedford is now speaking to Foxwoods, but I thought it was KG Urban that New Bedford was working with. What's happening?
Well, KG Urban is a developer. Foxwoods would be an operator, and that's one of the sticking points for KG Urban and their proposal. They've never been able to entice an operator to consider their spot on the waterfront. Foxwoods has apparently been talking with the mayor of New Bedford about an old site near the New Bedford Municipal Golf Course that 20 years ago Mayor Rosemary Tierney was trying to work with the Gayhead Aquina, Wampanoag, for that same spot. And she said at that time that they were on the one-yard line.
That's right. That quote echoed.
I guess they were on their own one-yard line.
Uh-oh. Okay. So now there's some concerns that if the New Bedford mayor is talking to Foxwoods, what about Fall River? Where does Fall River fall into this?
Well, Fall River is about as enthusiastic for a casino as anybody we've seen in this region. And they've been talking with Foxwoods. When this story broke, our reporter called the mayor of Fall River and asked him what he thought of this, and the mayor apparently said, "That's news to me." He called back a little later saying he'd spoken with the CEO at Foxwoods and was assured that everything is still going according to plan, but that plan hasn't really been falling into place for Fall River. Months ago, when they first started talking with Foxwoods, they said they'd have a host community agreement and a deal in a matter of days, and that's just stretched longer and longer without a deal.
So where do things boil down now? Where do we stand?
Well, it looks like everybody has to try to make their best business decision. It looks like Foxwoods is going to have to look at what really works for them between Fall River and New Bedford, where they've said that they gave up on the first site in Fall River and are looking for more space. KG Urban has said that they're happy to talk to Foxwoods and see if they're interested in their waterfront site. I think it has a lot to do with Foxwoods. I believe right now New Bedford is positioned quite well to make a move if the mayor, who it really boils down to, he's the one who has to be convinced. But if he can be convinced, Foxwoods is going to have to make their best business decision. All assuming, of course, that the Bureau of Indian Affairs doesn't grant land in trust to the Mashpee Wampanoag before all this takes place and assigns a tribal casino to this region.
Right, that would change everything. Okay, I know that the paper's been following another story, a hit-and-run driver story, and there was a verdict on that. Just briefly, tell us about that story. Very, very sad story.
Indeed. A woman who was an advocate for the disabled, she and her boyfriend were preparing to cross the street in Fairhaven, and a driver, a 37-year-old woman, had her 12-year-old son in the car and didn't see them and hit them, and the woman was killed. And she didn't stop. The driver didn't stop, and she was upset, didn't know whether she'd hit someone or something, and drove to a restaurant for a date with her mother. And from there, she heard helicopters and sirens and became more concerned, but still she decided to go to her brother's house to ask for counsel. Then from there, she went to the police about 3 hours after the accident.
Hmm.
Well, she's been found guilty on all counts, leaving the scene of an accident, resulting in death, motor vehicle homicide, leaving the scene, resulting in personal injury.
Mm-hmm.
And she'll be sentenced at the end of June. But
no drugs or alcohol?
No drugs or alcohol.
Oh.
Just a bad decision under stress. Really sad.
Yeah.
Nobody wins.
All right, Jim. Jim DeRuta is the editorial page editor at the New Bedford Standard Times and SouthCoastToday.com. You can follow the New Bedford Standard Times editorial page on Twitter at OpinionSCT, and the SCT stands for South Coast Today. Thank you, Jim. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Sean.
You're welcome. Jeff Spillane is on the phone. He's a reporter at the Mashpee Enterprise. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Sean, and happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. Ann Brennan is with me in our Woods Hole studio.
Good morning.
The Cape Cod Times, all the local papers, including the Mashpee Enterprise, have been really closely following the drug problem that has emerged on Cape Cod and in the islands and the South Coast over the past decade. The police chief, I understand, had a community forum in Mashpee to discuss this, the drugs and crime and everything related to it.
Yes, and that was yesterday afternoon, Sean. It was a community forum that was sponsored by Mashpee Cares, which is a community safety and wellness organization. And it was billed as a discussion of substance abuse and its relation to crime. And Police Chief Rodney Collins, who is very, very active in trying to obviously stop the flow of drugs coming through Mashpee, said he's never seen it as bad as it is now. and he's been doing this for about 30 years. And he said that about 90%, and he said that may even be a conservative number, 90% of the crime that is committed in Mashpee, whether it be serious crimes such as robberies, shootings, or your run-of-the-mill car break-ins, are related to a trickle-down effect to substance abuse. Mm. Some pretty stunning figures there.
Yeah, you know, in 2005, I did a series about heroin and the relationship to OxyContin and the opiate pills, and I was speaking with police chiefs and the DA up in Essex County, and they saw this thing coming. They talked about the property crimes that were coming and the people that were dying, young people in particular. And it was a big splash in the papers up there, and there was some reaction, but it seems like the legislators are just now kind of realizing how really bad this is and how it's tearing communities apart.
Exactly.
It kind of took Philip Seymour Hoffman's death to get people to see what a lot of us have been seeing at the local level for a long time. You're talking 2005.
Absolutely.
And, you know, the amount of crime, I mean, everybody has a stake in this. You can sit back and you can say, well, I'm not an addict. Why should I care? It's right. You have to care because there's so much crime related to this. And And as you say, that I can't remember the name of the drug that they just approved, it's a pure form of an opiate that doesn't have, aspirin in it and stuff. They approved that without it having a form that is tamper-proof.
Right.
And this drug is, everyone knows what's going to happen, that it's going to, people are going to get addicted to this, and it's just mushrooming out to this huge heroin problem because heroin is the least expensive.
Jeff, the past couple of weeks you've had stories about a retirement community called Southport.
Yes.
Very unexpected place to have heroin overdoses.
Yeah, it's rather shocking. And Chief Collins yesterday warned the audience, which by the way was a very small audience, unfortunately, only about 15 people, that you really can't stereotype the substance abuse users, the heroin users here in town or anywhere else for that matter. A lot of people say, geez, it's the young people. But here in Mashpee, in the course of 10 days, we've had two heroin-related incidents at the Southport Retirement Community. It's for active adults 55 and over. There was one incident on May 15th where a 63-year-old woman was found with a needle in her arm suffering from a heroin overdose. She had to be transported from Falmouth Hospital up to Brigham and Women's, and I guess she was in some dire straits. And then just last Sunday, a 57-year-old man was arrested at the gates of Southport after being followed by police with fresh track marks in his arm. So it is it's a problem that has gone beyond, I guess, the younger people.
Absolutely. Let's talk about the DPW work in the town of Mashpee right now. There's a beach renovation and dune stabilization projects going on. Are those things going to be done in time for the big crush of tourists and second homeowners and all that?
Well, I spoke with the Mashpee DPW director, Catherine Laurent, yesterday, a very busy woman these days, and she says, yes, things will be ready to go by June 23rd when the beach is open here in Mashpee. The largest project that is going on right now is at South Cape Beach. If you have a chance to get down there, it's very impressive to look at. The damage from Hurricane Sandy is being repaired. Mm-hmm. And right now there's large trenches being dug between the parking lot and the beach itself. And there are core envelopes filled with sand that are being buried. And then they have pilings on the side for the soft stabilization. And a man-made dune will be built and will be in place by June 23rd. And there'll be stairs going to the beach, which some people have expressed some concern about, because people are used to driving up to South Cape Beach and walking right from their car onto the beach, as well as sitting there in their cars and looking out at the sound. So it will have a different appearance when beaches open on June 23rd.
Okay. Jeff Spillane is a reporter at the Mashpee Enterprise, and we appreciate you joining us.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, Nelson Siegelman will join us on the phone. And welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI when we discuss the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in our Woods Hole studio is Ann Brennan, the Assistant Managing Editor for Digital Media at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. On the phone, Nelson Siegelman, the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hello, Nelson.
Hello. Hello.
Nice to speak with you. Really wonderful story in the paper this week about the Vineyard Five. Now, these are five vineyard women who went to North Carolina in 1964, and they were concerned about the Civil Rights Act.
Yes, it's a very interesting story. This comes from a series of interviews Lindsay Lee, an oral historian, made with these women. Lindsay's been doing a number of these sorts of interviews with different people and from all walks of vineyard life. And this was interesting, and we thought it was a timely story to run 50 years ago. It was a very different country, and Martha's Vineyard was a very different island, even quieter and certainly more out of the mainstream of life than it is now. So it was quite a trip for these five women to make, if you can imagine driving all the way down to the south and to Williamstown, North Carolina. And in fact, they spent a night in jail. So the entire experience was really unique and was very important for them. And they recount that in this story that we have in our community section.
Yes, we're very familiar with Lindsay Lee. She's done a lot of recording for us. Sure. You can hear her on our airwaves sometimes as well. So they were bringing food down there, and as you said, they spent a night in jail. I mean, some of the anecdotes that they shared about just the reception they encountered from locals, who they were bewildered that these young women from Martha's Vineyard would travel down there, and they didn't quite understand why.
Sure, and I think, you know, it's... of course, as is true probably of any small community, people were thinking, why are people coming from so far away to interfere in our lives? And I suppose the reaction might be the same on the Vineyard, but it was a very different time. And, of course, they were trying to do their part to bring real civil rights to the South. And it was a scary time as well, I think. You know, it's... People were being killed. People were being injured. They were being arrested, and they were being beaten. So it was really, I think in their comments, they don't speak about it, but it really was an act of bravery on their part.
Yeah, it was really, even though it was recorded, it's really a nice read. So I encourage people to go to the Martha's Vineyard Times website and check out that story. If you don't mind, Nelson, Anne Brennan is here from the Cape Cod Times, who were going to talk about the West Tisbury commemoration for Francis Pat Gregory. Did you attend that? Francis Pat Gregory, of course, was the town moderator in West Tisbury.
Yes, no, I didn't. We were getting the paper out for Thursday, and that was, in fact, we held the paper, the print edition, so we could be certain to have photos and a story about the memorial service in West Tisbury. It attracted more than 1,000 islanders. That's quite a crowd when you consider our population. And I think there are people who came out to honor Pat's memory, people who knew him, but also people who came out to make a statement about this kind of just mindless violence. So, and out of respect for the man, even if they had only a passing acquaintance with him, he was a man who was highly respected on the island.
Yeah, he seemed to be just about everywhere. He was a teacher. He owned his own business. He was town moderator since, for about 20 years?
Yes.
And the police chief was one of his students in seventh grade. So his roots go very deep in this community. And I was also, Nelson, surprised when I read that more than 1,000 people had gathered to memorialize him, yeah. Including his children and his college roommate. You know, he's a 69-year-old man, and his college roommate's coming to memorialize him as well. It's just really sad that somebody had commented that, you know, if you go for a walk out on Martha's Vineyard and somebody approaches you, you say hello. And that might have been their mindset when they were approached on the trail in Red Bluff, California.
Yeah, Nelson, just for those listeners who aren't familiar with this story, could you just remind us what happened to Mr. Gregory?
Yes, well, he had gone out to California with his wife to visit with some friends, and he was walking on a trail in Red Bluff, California. It's a nature trail. It's they weren't far from the turnoff on the highway, and a man robbed them and then shot them both, and Pat Gregory was killed, and his companion was wounded but survived and has been able to give some type of a description of the murderer, and police are now looking for him. So there have been no leads in the case, but it just shocked everyone because obviously why shoot them? So you rob them. Why now shoot these two elderly gentlemen? So it was pretty shocking to everyone here, I can certainly tell you that.
Absolutely.
And in it, there was a reward offered of $1,500 leading to the arrest and conviction of the person who committed this crime. Some people felt that wasn't enough money and started making donations. The last I heard, it was up to about $5,000.
Yes, I don't think that's a product of the donations. The sheriff's department bumped it up to $5,000. I was told from the spokesman out there that the amount of the reward wasn't really related to the investigation, in the sense that it's just what they start with is that amount. It's been a little bit difficult, really, to get information out of that department, I can tell you. So, I'm not sure where things quite stand right now.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Nelson. Of course, Nelson Sigelman is the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you, Nelson. Ann Brennan is with me in our Woods Hole studio. And Ann, let's talk about a fire station in Hyannis, which has gone up for, has it been two votes already?
I believe it's two. I think this is the third one.
So there'll be a third vote, and they keep shrinking this, or at least lowering the price for this fire station.
Right. So it started out as a $25 million building. It was reduced to about a $19 million project, or that's where it is at this point. It was reduced further to $19 million for a smaller. They went from about 42,000 square feet. Now the newest plan is 36,000 square feet. But they also hope to offset the cost of this by selling two pieces of property that are owned by the fire district to raise about $2 million to help pay for this station. So they're hoping to get a vote later this month. They have not. It would be on June 30th, but they haven't determined what time or where this would take place. But it is the third shot at trying to get a new fire department built in Hyannis.
There was a lot of controversy about the last vote regarding where they decided to hold the vote. It was in a school, one location, rather than in all the polling places. And that seems like a quick turnaround.
Right.
June 30th.
They also had concerns about, there was that lawsuit by one of a 10 taxpayer lawsuits saying this this project should be regulated by Proposition 2.5. The judge said no, it doesn't apply to a fire district.
Right.
But there was a huge number of people who showed up at the meeting. As you said, people had to watch on TV in some rooms. And there was also the feeling that they had it before people, the second homeowners, snowbirds, came back to Cape Cod, and that it might be more fair to have it when more people are here, since it is going to raise taxes.
And it sounds like since that vote, the only significant change they've made is going to sell that property to help offset
some of the
cost.
Reduced the size of the building by about 6,000 square feet. So it keeps shrinking. That's what from the original.
I guess you got to make it palatable to the
right.
voters. There's been a lot of talk about a third bridge over the. Well, we already have three bridges, but a third bridge for traffic and people coming on and off Cape Cod. And some people have been very positive about that, but others are concerned because it could have a toll, it could be privately run. I think we could talk about this for years. I don't know if it's ever going to happen, but go ahead. What's the latest on the third bridge? Last week,
state officials met with banking consulting firms that provided information about what a public-private partnership would look like if you were going to build a project like this. Now, they went before the Special Public-Private Partnership Infrastructure Oversight Commission, which was established after the legislature passed a law, I think about 4 years ago, that allowed this type of funding for public projects. Part of the problem is the gas tax revenues are shrinking because of fuel efficiency, and in part. And that's the money that used to go to fixing and maintaining roads. They're looking for new ways of doing this. So the consultants told the committee that there are two ways you can do it. One is that the private entity takes all the risk, and another would be kind of a hybrid of public and private together in their revenues and how they're raised. This would be a $320 million project. And as it stands now, the proposal is that the new bridge would be four lanes standing right next to this current Sagamore Bridge. There would be a connector built from just north of the Sagamore Bridge over to Route 25, just north of the Bourne Bridge. The new bridge would have a toll, no toll booth. It would be electronic toll collection. And the you could get onto Cape Cod on the toll bridge, and you get off on the current Sagamore Bridge, which would not have a toll. The Bourne Bridge would remain two lanes in each direction without a toll. And
so you wouldn't be able to get on via the Sagamore Bridge anymore. Only be for off.
Right. It would only be for
so
off.
So that would leave the new bridge and the Bourne as your only options
of getting to get on.
To get on. And some of this is also driven not just by, well, we want to make things easier for folks to get on here on the weekends and on vacations. It's also concerns about if we ever needed to evacuate.
Right. The estimates for getting off Cape Cod, well, we just look at past history. Eduardo, about 7-8 years ago, Eduardo was a hurricane heading towards Cape Cod, and people getting off, the traffic backed up to exit 9 or 10 for hours. So getting off, if there were an emergency at the nuclear power station, getting people off Cape is very difficult. And, on the Bourne Bridge side of the world, you don't get the huge traffic backups that you get on the Sagamore Bridge side of the world. So,
side of the world,
side of
that.
The canal.
Yeah. That's Cape Cod talk right there.
So this would allow four lanes off if they needed to. They could open both bridges to get people off the Cape. They're also saying, and anybody who's using the bridge in the last 4 or 5 years knows that all the work that's been going on the Sagamore Bridge, even in the off season when they have lane restrictions, there's huge backups and local traffic even in the off season.
Right.
So it's something like 22,000 cars go over the Sagamore Bridge every day in the regular, on the off season.
I see.
So they are looking at many reasons for having this bridge. There's business concerns, there's safety concerns, and the Sagamore and Bourne bridges are about 80 years old as well.
They seem to be well maintained. They're certainly working on them well enough, long enough. Let's finish off with a very positive story. Folks who might be heading out to the National Seashore, maybe there were some concerns about those beaches out there and all the storms we've had, but it sounds like they're ready to go.
Well, Herring Cove parking lot was damaged in a storm in January. Seawall was breached, and the pieces of it went on the beach and also pockmarked the parking lot. The parking lot is a drive-up parking lot, so you can go right up to the beach in this parking lot. So it's very popular to look at sunsets as well as go to the beach. So it's a year-round. It's popular. They had to make repairs to it, and those repairs were finished and ready. So the parking lot was ready last weekend by Memorial Day. And also a stairway that actually it was a brand new stairway. It was less than a year old, leading to Nauset Light Beach in East Ham. The bottom of that was washed away in a storm. Those stairs have been replaced as well.
Great. More access to the beaches, and hopefully we have some good weather coming up to take advantage of those. Okay, I want to thank my guest, Anne Brennan. She's the Assistant Managing Editor for Digital Media at the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodOnline.com. She joined me in our Woods Hole studio. Thank you, Anne.
Thank you, Sean.
You can follow Anne on Twitter at AnneBrennanCCT. Thanks to our other contributors, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jim Deruta of the New Bedford Standard Times, our newest contributor, Jeff Spillane of the Mashpee Enterprise called in, and Nelson Siegelman, we spoke with him from the Martha's Vineyard Times as well. Thanks to you for listening to the local and regional news roundup on WCAI. I'm Sean Corcoran.